Attention, shoppers.
Okay, here we go. The Senate Interim Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs will come to order. Before we proceed, Madam Vice Chair?
Yes. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm always in the habit of reading poems from the Voices of the Guard. And these are soldiers and family members from the Oregon National Guard. And they've printed a pamphlet, and it is called Voices of the Guard. And I would like to read one little snippet from one of our members of the Guard that was in Iraq. And he titled this, The Best Moment. I think it was probably only about a month after we had been there. Sergeant Jock, you know, he was my platoon sergeant, and I was just a private, so we weren't real, like, real close. It wasn't like you could just go up and start talking to him, or at least I didn't feel that way at first. And one day, something had kind of got me down. I don't remember what it was, and I was just sitting outside cleaning one of the machine guns, and he came up to me and started talking to me and asking me questions here and there. And then me and him just kind of sat down and cleaned that machine gun for about 2 hours straight. And you know, it felt more like the kind of connection a father and son would have. I can say that was my fondest moment in Iraq. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
I could tell a story about 50 cal machine guns in Iraq, but I won't.
All right.
I'm going to open a informational meeting for the purpose of discussing legislative concepts. Before I do that, I just want to point out a couple things, because we're going to have some different individuals talk about legislative concepts, so we all get a kind of a briefing on what they are, and then after that we'll move into a work session, and we'll bring them in all in mass. And I just remind the public that when we do bring in legislative concepts and a committee brings forth bills, it's not that the committee is going to pass the bill or that the members are in favor of it. It's simply a vote that to bring it forward and have the discussion. Having said that, we have several of the bills today that are works in progress, I will say. And without taking on other branches of the legislature and ourselves, we'll just say they're works in progress, and some of them need some changes and didn't exactly come out in the form we anticipated, and some of you know some of them only came out about 11 minutes ago. So we have some work to do on those. But with that, what I'd like to do is you have an agenda, and we're going to work down through the agenda first and get from Senator Olson an explanation of LC5 and LC79, and then we're going to move on to 124, 151, and 267, after which we'll open a work session for the purpose of introducing those bills. Senator Olson, if you'd be kind enough to...
You want me up front, or you want
No,
me
you can, right here is perfectly fine, because we're going to move quick.
Okay. We'll start with LC5 then. LC5 basically was a compilation of work groups that we put over on the summertime. And it's a rework of the Dash 10 amendment from last year. And we added some concepts and some items to it that we thought were appropriate. And it covers, we added some new definitions called building unit identifiers.
Yeah.
And if I get to the right file, I could be talking a little bit more about it correctly.
Okay.
I think it's a bill that should be well supported. It will bring our systems up to date for the future. I know there's going to be some more work to it, and more designations needed to be added. We probably might amend it a little bit for clarity and those folks, but it seemed that the work group was pretty consistent with that this is a good piece of legislation and it should move forward. Once again, the best part about it is we built in the building unit identifier so that we know that if there is a problem on the third floor and room 318, we know that it's room 318 and the fire department can go directly there, or the emergency folks can go directly there. So that's a brief overview of that one.
Okay.
And in LC79 was the one that just came off hot off the presses, and it still basically eliminates an item. And what the bill did was prevent sweeps of the 911 funds. And it was a difficult process to get there because of contractual obligations and other things. So basically what I had stated in the bill that I wanted it to say was that if we have a fiscal emergency, the governor must declare that we have such emergency, and then he can go ahead and take those funds or look at taking those funds. Unfortunately, it didn't come out with the governor on there, so we will probably amend it unless everybody loves it the way it is. But basically, we stated that a fiscal emergency means a projected deficit for the biennium, as most recently projected by the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, of at least 12% below the amounts estimated to be received for the biennium, as estimated under after adjournment sine die of the odd number year regular session of the Legislative Assembly. So basically, we put a real high threshold on this bill. So if the governor, and I will amend it to make put the governor's face on it, I don't care which governor or who the governor is, if he wants the money and he needs it that desperately, I want him to say, I need it, so the people understand it is the governor taking it. And so we will amend that bill, but that's LC, the draft of LC 79.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Using the chair's prerogative, I see the fine ladies from the Oregon coast have come in, Senator Verger and Representative Cowan, if you'd be kind enough to go ahead and come forward and discuss LC 267, if you'd like to. While they're coming up, Counselor, you want to give a quick review of 267?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. LC 267 relating to members of the uniformed services extends certain rights and benefits already available to members of the military, to members of the commissioned corps of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to permit some similar treatment and protections when members are relocated and called to active duty.
Thank you. Madam Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joanne Verger, and I serve in representing Senate District 5 on the coast, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate your allowing me to be here today to testify about LC 267. It is really a pleasure to be able to be here to testify about Newport, because we are so proud of the NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration location there at Newport. It's brought wonderful success, 175 jobs, 6 ships, and $9 million, and it's onward and upward. But we're here today to talk to you about the Corps members, the service members that have never been treated as military, so they don't have the benefits that other military have. And we're here, you have printed testimony in front of you, and it's just simply to ask you to recognize them for the work that they do. Your printed testimony explains what NOAA does, their responsibilities, and also what the Corps service members do. And it would benefit them greatly. It also, as they move on to other places and others move in, it would be a much better transition. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having us here.
Thank you, Madam Senator.
Thank you, Chair Boquist. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I am proud to represent House District 10 and live in Newport, home of the new NOAA home port. So if you will please allow me to say NOAA from here on out after we have gotten National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration out there a couple of times, and I think all three of us have managed to stumble over that. You can understand why we refer to it as NOAA. I found it really interesting when Senator Verger and I received an email from one of the commissioned officers, actually on the Belle M. Shimada, the newest ship in the fleet, sort of explaining that there is the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act on a national basis, but then each state treats things a little bit differently, and I think more by virtue of oversight than anything else. The NOAA commissioned officers, the Corps, has not been included in the list of exemptions for a variety of things that we exempt military personnel for. In-state tuition, I think perhaps hunting and fishing licenses was important along the way, a variety of things. And our statutes list, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, go through everybody except NOAA. So that was the reason that he requested us to take a look at this. I found it a really educational process to discover that, and these individuals are a branch of the military. They are not requested, but informed that they will be moving periodically. And so for all of the other reasons that we exempt military personnel from some of those challenges that they might have from moving state to state, it's only fair that we include the NOAA commissioned officers as well. And it's important to a number of individuals who now call Newport their home port.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Sarah. Questions? I do have a question for you two esteemed ladies. It was brought to my attention, and we've been at this since 05, and it was brought to my attention, though, earlier that there's actually another category, the uniform health care service officers in which served in wartime, which are left out of the existing law, too. And so I guess my question is, why would we fix it twice? Do you have a problem with us amending in the future, considering an amendment to put the uniform health care service officers who serve in wartime into the bill?
I would have no problem with that. I think there's seven categories of uniform service officers, and I would have no problem in doing it. I don't know of any reason why you would want to do it twice.
The legislature, Madam Senator, you know.
You just heard testimony on 911, and I think you and I did the same thing in 2005, so here we are.
Representative, any problem with that?
No, not at all. Thanks. All right,
thank you. If there's no further questions, appreciate your testimony in regard to LC 267. With that, thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Appreciate it. We're going to move on to LC 124, and I'll remind members again, when we go into work session, council will go through and give the boilerplate explanation of these, and we vote them in block. LC 124 is relating to the military department, which is actually some technical changes to the Homeland Security Council, which falls under Emergency Service of Homeland Security Office of Emergency Management in the Military Department, which back in 2005, Senator Berger and I then co-chaired a committee that did that bill, and those are technical changes. With that, LC 151, Madam Vice Chair, would you like to address this issue or have someone address it for you?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're wondering probably why diabetes is in the Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. We ran out of committee bills in my health committee, and Senator Boquist was kind enough to say we could introduce this here. So I'm not going to spend really much time at all on this. It basically is going to require Oregon Health Authority, the Department of Human Services, and the Public Employees Benefit Board to develop goals, benchmarks, and plans to address diabetes, diabetes care, complications from diabetes, and then require a report to the Legislative Assembly. Diabetes is a really really huge problem in this state nationwide and among our servicemen also, so and women. And so I don't think we need to really go into anything because this will probably not be referred to this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate that information. With that, I'm going to...
Oh, and it was on behalf of Novo Nordisk.
I see Nicolina out there.
Yeah, Nicolina out there. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate that. And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on legislative concepts and open a work session. And again, I'd point out that a vote in favor of introducing a concept is not a vote in favor of the bill. And as you've heard, some of these might not be in this committee, and some of them need substantial work. With that, what I'm going to do is, for the record, as we're in a work session, is ask Legislative Council to do a brief review of each of those bills, at which time I'll entertain a motion to adopt them en masse.
Chair and members of the committee, just a recap, LC-5 relating to 911 emergency communications that applies existing requirements to inbound 911 calls to provide automatic, accurate location and callback information to calls that originate from multi-line phone systems. Multi-line phone systems are not specifically included in current statute. And it exempts multi-line phone systems already installed and those installed during the first 12 months after passage. LC-79, I apologize, it is intended to prohibit funding sweeps because it was delivered from Legislative Council's office so recently I haven't had a time to summarize. LC-124, relating to the Oregon Military Department, as Chair Boquist indicated, modifies the duties and membership of the Oregon Homeland Security Council, consistent with its original intent and with the House Joint Resolution 7, should that go into effect after the next general election, allowing the Governor and the Legislative Assembly to take certain actions in the event of a catastrophic disaster. LC-151, related to diabetes, as Vice Chair Montes Anderson indicated, requires health agencies and public employees benefit board to develop goals, benchmarks, and plans to address diabetes and diabetes-related care and to report to the legislature. And LC 267, excuse me, extends certain rights and benefits, as I said already, that are already available to members of the military, to the members of the Commissioned Corps of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
Yes, Ms. Chair Boquist, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 5, dated 1-17-12, LC 79, dated 1-19-12, LC 124, dated 12-16-11, LC 151, dated 12-21-11, and LC 267, dated 1-6-12.
Senator Montes Anderson moves that LCs 5, 79, 124, 151, and 267 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? And again, I would just remind everybody, a vote in favor of it merely introducing a legislative concept is not a vote in favor of the concept itself. If there's no discussion, Clerk, will you please call the roll?
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Montes Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Boquist?
Aye. The motion passes. The measures are introduced as committee bills. And with that, I'm going to close the work session that was open for the purpose of legislative concepts and move on to an informational meeting on the Oregon Military Assistance Helpline. With that, I think I'm going to ask Julie Marshall and General Caldwell and crew to come forward. My list shows two, General, and there's three.
There is.
As an infantryman, I can count, especially when I'm short on magazines.
I wouldn't want to get near that computer because I'll break it. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Reagan Military Department, also the interim head of emergency management, and I can report that we're very busy today, so we're actively working the storm as well. I'd like to go over just a couple points of interest to the committee with respect to the current military helpline contractor. As you know, the Oregon Partnership federal contract expired on the 4 April of 11, and there was continuing resolutions, as you recall, in the federal budget, which slowed any additional funds coming to the Oregon Military Department to extend that. By the time the money did arrive, the period had elapsed, and there was no way to continue on with that contract. Again, because of the lateness of the Congress's dilly-dallying around with the money, there was only a short window to execute on the money that we did get, so we selected and went through a process, and it had to be a low bid process. Just by the nature of the kind of money they sent us and the rules that they imposed, they being the National Guard Bureau. There were four bids that were received, and Cascade is was the lowest bidder, and I'm pleased to report to you today that not only were they the low bidder, but they have met or exceeded every single one of the categories inside the contract, and at this point we are very pleased with what we have seen their efforts, what they have done at this point. So with that, it's kind of an overall kind of look at things. This has been, with no earmarks in Congress any longer, this has been basically these monies were appropriated to us basically through our delegation's strong will of effort, I guess, with their colleagues in the Congress, and that's how this money came. There's no guarantee it'll be here a year from now. And again, we're seeing other reductions in our budgets as well, and we're probably going to see at least at a minimum, we've seen a 52% reduction in state money for this program in state dollars, and the federal dollars have gone down about $185,000. So we're going the wrong direction with respect to that and these types of services, and I think anything we're looking at, how do we streamline, how do we get as much technology into this business we can this year, so we, because we know we're not going to have people to go eyeball to eyeball with them, so it's going to be real important that we have good relationships with the other organizations we deal with, like the VA and the ODVA and anybody else that's out there, which reminds me, we'll have a summit coming up here in the first part of March. I don't remember the date, but 1st of March. I guess that's the first part. And that's where we strengthen these relationships, and I think it's paid us great dividends. We have a lot of energy out there in the communities, and these relationships are linked together, but we still have to coordinate that effort. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Marshall, who is, like I said, with Cascade, and let her lead you through her presentation. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. Thank you for inviting us here to brief you this afternoon. My name is Dr. Julie Marshall. I'm a clinical psychologist licensed in the state of Oregon. I've worked with Cascade Centers Incorporated for a little over 14 years. My title is Vice President of Clinical and Operational Services, so that also does a good job of describing my role. I oversee the, we're having some technical difficulties.
It's a computer.
Should have sat on the other side.
I should have sat over
here. It was
your
fault. So I oversee, I can keep talking. We don't need the slides. Good job. Thank you. So I oversee the clinical aspects of the program as well as the operations, and that includes the military helpline. And I'm here presenting, in addition to General Caldwell, with Doug Kuhl, retired Colonel Doug Kuhl. He's retired from the Oregon National Guard for 24 years and active duty 20 years. He's a combat vet. He served in Afghanistan, and he works full-time right now for Cascade Centers as our director of outreach. So he is in charge of outreach and promotion of the program, which is a really critical piece of the program, and he'll be talking about that in a little bit also. So as I said, we appreciate the opportunity to describe to you Cascade and our history and our services, in particular the military helpline. As you know, the military helpline is a critical program, and I know you wanted us to come here and talk to you today because of the importance of this program, and you want to make sure it's being delivered by a qualified quality program. And I want you to know that we are very honored at Cascade to provide this service. Our staff is very passionate about serving the Oregon Guard and their families in this way, and we take this very seriously, and we have developed a very comprehensive quality program for you. So Cascade Centers, we've been in business for 36 years. We primarily provide employee assistance services, so that's phone counseling, crisis intervention, face-to-face counseling. We serve over 250 organizations. That includes the state of Oregon. We've provided the employee assistance services for the state of Oregon for about 25 years. That includes the Oregon Military Department as well as other military personnel through our employee assistance services. Let's go ahead. So for those of you who might not be as familiar with employee assistance programs or EAP, what that means is we work with employers to provide our services as a benefit to their employees. So those services include face-to-face counseling. We have a statewide panel of face-to-face counselors as well as nationwide to provide that face-to-face. The crisis intervention, 24-hour crisis intervention, and also another set of services we call work-family-life services, which include those issues that may not be behavioral health or mental health issues, but also impact people just as significantly. So financial issues, legal issues, child care, elder care. And in that way, our mission really has been prevention-based. So we not only want to be providing expert care in times of crisis, but we also want to be there for people before they reach that crisis point by providing them services, like a wraparound services that help them with all those issues that may be impacting them. And I think you'll be able to see that prevention focus in the development of our military helpline program. So Cascade annually responds to over 145,000 calls. And as I said, we're not only focused on crisis intervention, but that prevention as well. So as you know, through your own personal experiences, your communications with service members, the testimony that you hear in this room, that service members are faced with many challenges and stressors throughout the deployment cycle, before, during, and of course ongoing after that. And whether the service member has been deployed or not, they face significant challenges. And I know you've probably seen this list and know about these issues. These are the most common issues that we see. Failed relationships, legal problems, employment, unemployment issues, which is always usually closely tied with financial issues. And on our helpline right now, the two most common presenting issues have been unemployment, stress due to that, and financial issues, both people calling us in crisis because of those issues and also wanting resources to handle those issues. So what we know about people who are suicidal is that they are overwhelmed. Many times at its core, and most of the time, suicidal ideation is based with depression. But what happens is one or more significant stressors hit a person and puts them to the state where their problem solving shuts down. And what happens is, at that point, they don't see any other way out except for suicide. And so that's why, as you know, it's critical to be able to reach these people, to be able to do that escalation and intervention and provide them hope in another way to solve their issue besides suicide. To give you an example of one of the calls we took most recently on the helpline, an Oregon Guard service member called in. And she reported that she had suicidal thoughts. So as our master's level counselor talked to her and what was going on for her, she reported that she had had a big, huge blow up with her husband that was very distressing for her. And she felt at that point that her marriage was going to be destroyed. And for her, that was devastating because to her report to our counselor, she didn't know how she was going to go on without her husband. And so as our counselor talked to her about what was going on, what were the issues with the marriage and how she was feeling, she weaved in that suicidal risk assessment and deemed that she was very high risk for suicide. She had strong suicidal thoughts, the ideation. She had intent. She had the means. And she had a plan. Her plan was that night she was going to take her car out and create a fatal car crash. So our counselor talked to her, worked with her around what those issues were, and started to talk to her about what other options there were as she was counseling her. Got her to the point where she was at a safe place, had de-escalated her, and though that counselor felt, though, she needed to get to face-to-face counseling, and she needed that day, as well as ongoing to deal with the issues that were going on. So we have a database of military resources, and we work with, one of the resources we work with provides pro bono counseling for vets. So she worked with that organization, worked to find a counselor who was willing to move some appointments around, got that service member in that day, followed up and facilitated that appointment, made sure she made it to the appointment, followed up with the counselor to make sure that he was going to continue on, and then also followed up with the service member to make sure that she felt she got the services she needed. And I think her husband ended up getting involved in the treatment. So what that shows you is a glimpse into how we deal with a suicidal caller. But the piece that's really important about our program is both the assisted referral, we call that, and the follow-up. We don't give a person just a name or a number to call when we find the resource, and especially in the case where there's suicidal ideation, we make sure that they make it to that resource. So we're doing the calls, we're setting up the appointments, we're doing the follow-up to make sure that they make it there. And the reason for that is, even if we gave them a resource we knew was available, if they hit any kind of barrier at that point, that could make them go right back to the point at risk with that suicidal ideation, and we don't want that to happen. So we really follow up to make sure that they get to that resource that they need. All our services are completely confidential. And it's real important, as you know, for these service members to have a place outside of the military to call that they can feel is confidential. People can call in anonymously. They don't need to give us their name or any identifying information. It is helpful at times for us to have that when we need to call for follow-up or to provide resources. But if they don't want to provide that information, they don't need to. And in fact, at this point, 26% of our calls into the helpline have been anonymous. So we have a dedicated phone number for the military helpline that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And as I had said before, for us, really being there in crisis is very important, but also providing that information and resources to help people so it doesn't get to that point of crisis. If the earlier we can intervene, the better. And so we really want to be that one point to be able to find people. We are resource experts. In our 36 years of working, we know how to connect people with resources. That's our expertise. And that's what we want to be able to provide here. An example of that, we had a service member, Oregon Guard member, who called, who had recently been lost his job. So understandably, that was very distressing. He called us because he wanted to know what resources we could provide him with his job search. So our master's level counselor talked to him, immediately started providing him with resources. For example, we connected him with the Veterans Employment Rep at WorkSource Oregon, offered to review his resume, which he took us up on. We provided him feedback on that, which he incorporated and then asked us to look at a final copy. We connected him with a couple employers in the area who we knew were vet-friendly, who were also hiring. And this is an ongoing case, so I'm not sure now what the next step is. So at our follow-up call, I'm hoping we're going to be wishing him congratulations. But if not, we're going to be working with him to continue in that employment search. And the piece about that that's really important is, as you know, the longer he is unemployed, the more increased those stressors are going to get for him. His finances are going to get more strained. He's going to feel more stress, family stress, and he's going to have that relationship with this counselor who, you know, has been all along, as they've been working with him on resources, checking in with how he's doing and how he's handling this stress, and so that he'll be able to continue doing that. So just a little bit about our staff. We have a very highly experienced staff. Our master's level, all our counselors are master's level or above. And I think it speaks to Cascade and the passion that our counselors have. Our average tenure of our counselors is 9.5 years. So we have very experienced staff. So in addition to the clinical training they receive through their master's, it's a core part of Cascade to provide continuing training. So in terms of critical crisis intervention, we provide training that's based on the recognized practices of the National Suicide Foundation. We provide training on post-traumatic stress, military sexual trauma, substance abuse. So, and that's ongoing, and that's a real critical component. We have two full-time veteran salaried staff. They're combat veterans. Doug Kuhl, who you will hear from in a minute, he is in charge and is mainly busy with our outreach and coordination. But even in his contacts at times, vets want to talk to him. So he's been trained as a vet counselor. He's taken the assist training, the applied suicide intervention skills training. We have another combat vet on staff who's a master's level counselor who provides counseling on the helpline. We also have available to us 10 master's level veterans counselors to be able to provide services if needed. What we found is what happens is once veterans make that that connection when they call in and are able to build that relationship with that counselor and feel heard, that's what they're connecting with. But many times vets call in and they just want to talk to a vet, and that's very understandable. And when that happens, we make sure that they are able to do that. So I've said most of the things that are on this slide about our suicide prevention program. One of the things I want to say that I think really sets us apart and makes us a strong program in our suicide intervention are our counselors, and that they are master's level counselors with their training. So not only are they able to provide that important de-escalation and intervention with the crisis, they're able to provide counseling around all the issues that are impacting that service member then, whether that's marital issues, substance abuse, trauma, and really talk to them and counsel with them and do that thorough assessment and even intervention right then, and being able to make a very good clinical assessment and recommendation around what treatment they may need further. And I think that's the strength of our program. So we provide that assisted referral, as I said. We facilitate those resources, that follow-up, and especially with suicide callers, it's so important to continue to follow up. One of the things that we're proud of that's happened most recently in the last couple weeks is we've been accredited by the American Association of Suicidology. They did their site visit with us 2 weeks ago. So that means we've met their high standards that establishes our program as a quality suicide prevention helpline. So I'm going to turn it over to Doug to talk some about the program promotion and outreach that we're doing.
Thank you, Dr. Marshall. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Kuhl, and I'm a resident of Oregon City. I am the Director of Veterans Outreach for the Oregon Military Assistance Helpline. And really, the crux of our whole program, if we're going to be successful, is doing the outreach and trying to get the soldiers and family members to utilize our program. So we've really attacked this full with everything we've got. in your packet that you just received, we've got an example of our magnets that we hand out. For some reason, soldiers just love these, or at least family members do. They tend to stay on refrigerators for years and years and, you know, hold kids' papers and do other things. But when family members in crisis, they tend to look for these magnets. So whether it's the reintegration magnet or it's our magnet, magnets seem to be one of the top things that soldiers do utilize. We've also got examples of all of our posters in your packet. We've made enough of these so that we can get them out to every single unit, pretty much put them in every restroom, every bulletin board. We've also blown these up to like a cinema-sized poster, and there's enough of those to go to each armory, and those have started hitting the armories in about November. And then we've done a lot of work trying to get newsletter articles and advertisement into the family programs newsletters that go out monthly, and then also out into the Oregon Sentinel, which is the official newsletter that goes out to all the soldiers and service members in the National Guard. Outreach activities. So I've spent probably 50% of my time outside the office meeting with key staff in the Oregon National Guard, key leaders throughout the organization, and then all of the support elements that are really makes Oregon stand out amongst all the other states as far as our reintegration team. And so I meet with those people face-to-face. Typically, we spend anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours discussing how we can assist them with soldiers in crisis, stressing that, you know, if they've got a soldier that's in crisis, they can contact us immediately, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and instantly they have a professional master's level counselor available to speak with them. Also, we tend to do a lot of referrals out to organizations within the community, and I've spent a lot of time meeting face-to-face with all of those people to make sure that they are what they say they are and that they can provide the service that we think they can, and just have that dialogue and discussion on, you know, what things can we do to better help them and what things can they provide to those soldiers that are and service members that are calling in to us looking for assistance. So I've met with probably 90% of all the organizations that we would refer someone to. And if I haven't met with them face-to-face, I've probably sat with them over a lunch or something else in a community organization where we're networking. So I feel pretty confident that we have a good network of resources for the service members. Just for an example of how all this networking has paid off, I have a case example where after building a relationship with the family program at 41st Brigade and networking with the Oregon Military Support Network and meeting probably 30 different veteran service members, a couple days prior to Thanksgiving, I had, or at least one of our counselors had, an individual soldier call in, and he simply was looking for free counseling. He said that he was having some trouble dealing with stress, but everything was fine right now, but he felt like he would be able to do better if he could get that resource. At the same time, probably within an hour of that phone call, I personally received a phone call from one of the leaders in the National Guard, his squad leader. At the time, I didn't know it was his squad leader. Squad leader was saying that he had a soldier who, during drill, had presented some suicidal ideation, and they felt it was necessary to take him to the Veterans Hospital. And they did that. Veterans Hospital, they basically took him kicking and screaming, saying he didn't want to go to the Veterans Hospital. So when he got there, the Veterans Hospital was able to assess him. Basically he told the Veterans Hospital that he was fine, he didn't really want to be there. They said, are you sure? You know, here's some resources, gave him some pamphlets and sent him back to the unit and back to drill. So the squad leader obviously was a little frustrated with that and wanted some tools and some techniques that he could work with to help the soldier. So we talked about how to develop a safe plan for the soldier, some steps that the squad leader and the soldier could work on together so that if, you know, the soldier was feeling overwhelmed again, he would have some measures that he could take. And then we talked about some of the resources that were out there, and obviously utilizing our site. So the squad leader felt pretty confident that he was going to be able to do that. He realized that if it was overwhelming, he would contact us immediately. Following Thanksgiving, I started reviewing all our notes and started thinking that these two cases were probably linked together. So I contacted my point of contact over at 41st Brigade, and through our conversation, we were talking, and she brought up that during drill that she had a soldier who had come to her. It was a squad leader, and said that they had a soldier that said that he was going to bite a bullet, and she didn't know what that meant, so she asked him, and he explained that the soldier had said that he was going to take a service revolver and stick it in his mouth and end his life. And so right away I knew we were talking about the same case. She said that she'd referred the squad leader to me, and that was about November 22nd, which was the exact day that he'd called me. So then I thought, wow, this is pretty significant, and I better call back all these people. So tried contacting that soldier. We had his contact information. Tried contacting him. His voicemail came on. The voicemail was full, but I was able to leave back a contact number for him to call me back. We had his email, so I sent him an email. And then I called the squad leader back, and the squad leader said, hey, sir, I'm glad that you called me. This soldier had reportedly gotten into an argument with his wife. It was fairly heated. Utilizing the safe plan that he and the soldier had developed, they decided that they better call 911 and get the police down there. The police responded. They had to knock in the door. They could hear the two yelling at each other, and it sounded like it was pretty violent. So they knocked in the door, guns drawn, and ended up having to secure the soldier. Both the soldier and the wife were pretty drunk, but they felt like the soldier was at the verge of committing suicide or perhaps even harm to his wife. And they ended up taking him into a facility where he could be watched 24 hours a day for the next 3 days, which is the limit that they can hold a person. During that time, he was able to get some more counseling, and started to show improvement, according to the squad leader. The squad leader was also able to get him to commit to going to the resources that we had referred him to. And so he felt like we were starting to head in the right direction. After I got off the phone with the squad leader, probably about an hour later, the soldier emailed me and said, simple email, that he was just looking for work and could I assist him. So I immediately called him back. This time I got him on the line. We talked for about an hour about, all the issues that were pretty much overwhelming him. He had been laid off from work. He'd lost his license on the first day that he'd called me. And he just felt like, there was really no more purpose in his life, and felt like he was at wit's end. I told him that, there's all kinds of resources out there available to him, and that, going to a squad leader is probably one of the best things that he could have done, and he agreed. And I could tell that there was a tight bond between him and his squad leader. And then we just talked about all the different avenues that he had other than, going and actually ending his life. And then we started talking about how he needed to start taking ownership of his situation and start making improvements. And so then he started asking about what resources were available to him. I referred him to the joint assistance team that the military department has. Great job program that they have, and that he should meet with those guys. He agreed that he would do that. And so I was able to transfer that call to them. They set up, we all three of us were on the phone at this point. They set up an appointment for him. He made his appointment, has met with Don Weber a couple times now. They've gone through building resumes and that kind of stuff. So then we hung up with Don Weber, and then we called the Family Assistance Center and got him some more resources, got him signed up for an emergency relief loan, because at this point now there was no way he was going to be able to pay his rent, which was coming due like in days. And so got him signed up for emergency relief loan. And so he was feeling pretty good about how things were turning out. And that was basically how that phone call ended. About a week later, the squad leader had called again and said that, you know, the soldier had really made great improvement, was going to his counselor, told me that they were able to get the first emergency relief loan, and that, you know, the soldier was starting to get some interviews. So things were looking really good there. Then just before Christmas, I made some more contact with the soldier. He said that, yeah, everything had been going well. And over this period of time, now he had received about $2,100 in emergency relief loans. He agreed that he had been meeting with his counselor weekly, that he and Don Weber had been able to set up some really good interviews, and he felt confident with his resume and his interviewing skills. He'd also, through the Family Support Assistance Center, was also able to get some other resources, and then through the readiness group at the 41st Brigade, they were able to give him $50 gift certificates every time that he was running out of food. So he thanked us for our service, and then it was about a week later, so after Christmas, we got another phone call from the squad leader and said now that the wife was seeking help. She had admitted that, you know, she was an alcoholic and she wanted to start seeking treatment. And she also exhibited some suicidal behavior herself. So we were able to contact her and do basically the same thing we had done with him. Gave her some options for treatment. So far she has declined to go to any of those. But she is at least, you know, she's no longer attending bars, and so we think we're making progress there. And we really feel that if it wasn't for this program and the network that the National Guard has, that this clearly would not have ended the way that it has so far in a positive note. So then let me go on to this slide. We have a very active Facebook page that the soldiers seem to enjoy. We've posted multiple articles that they find interesting, most of them dealing with how to reintegrate or how to prepare for deployment or how to cope during deployment for the family members that, you know, have loved ones that are overseas. We've also worked with Bill Shonley to come up with a PSA that we've posted out on our YouTube channel. It's in a draft form right now, but it's professional quality, and we're just waiting to make sure that it's got the message down, and hopefully soon we'll have that out from the general public. And then we've been using Google to publicize our website and to try to get more interaction with our website. So speaking of our website, we probably have about 180 to 200 different resources that are available to soldiers. Our website is very interactive, and soldiers have told us that, you know, it's really what they've been looking for as far as a one spot that they could go to find the resources that they're looking for. It's been very helpful for soldiers that are and family members that are out, like in Milton Freewater or out in Klamath Falls, where it's not as convenient for them to come into Salem or Portland, where all the resources are. But they can just go to the website, and if they need, you know, a mental health, or if they need rent assistance, or if they're having trouble with some sort of an appliance, we've got all those kind of resources on there, and they can just turn to that and get the assistance they need. We've also got quite a few videos on there that seem to get a lot of attention with the soldiers. And then as they work through our website, there's a number of interactive web tools that will help them deal with all kinds of subjects, from buying a new house to how to deal with stress and how to get a better job. And so it's been pretty influential for all of the soldiers.
Just the final piece to mention that's part of the contract is providing suicide prevention classes. So those are three-hour classes that are held, and they're at the discretion of the Oregon Guard. They have had our audience be the family readiness coordinators. So usually they are held at the Yellow Ribbon events. We've done three of those so far. Another one, I think, is going to be scheduled in February. We'll do a total of about 9 to 12 of those. And those are based on evidence-based ways that they can do some basic problem solving. They can do identification. How do you identify that ideation? What do you do to help somebody? How do you get to somebody? How do you get somebody who is suicidal to help? And so that's the basics of those classes. And we've been doing promotion of those as they've occurred, both through posters and different announcements. And that's the end of the presentation.
Madam Vice Chair, questions?
I have a number of questions.
Go to it.
Okay. When the contract went out to bid, the contract was awarded, and it was $100,000, right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moniz Anderson, that's correct.
And so you're able to do all of this with $100,000?
It's $103,387.
So how many people do you have on staff?
We have on staff a total of 25 people, and there are 14 of those are counselors, 15. So, I know that question has come up, and I know that that's a primary question that we get. And we have the existing infrastructure, we have the staff, we have the technology, and so we laid the helpline on top of that. We've been bidding business for 36 years, so we needed to tie the utilization on top of that for the helpline, and we were able to do that. Now, we knew we needed to provide a competitive bid, and that's what we did, but we didn't provide a bid that we were losing money on. So
when you call in and you're suicidal, mm-hmm. what's the menu like?
You get a live caller with a live answer within three rings.
So when I call 511-6944,
uh-huh.
okay, because now this is what I've heard on the street. There are two cell phones, two people.
No.
So this is a call center?
Yes. That's absolutely false. We have pretty sophisticated technology. We had to put in a new phone system 5 years ago that's with the latest technology, and you call in, you get our call center, which is staffed with counselors, so within three rings you get a live caller, a live answer, who will take care of your request, what your service you need.
So how many calls do you get for suicide?
For the military helpline or?
For suicide.
For just overall, for our book of business.
Well, both then.
Okay. Sure.
How many calls do you get? I know there's the military helpline, so you're able to help with a vast arena of things,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right, right.
But if you're suicidal, and I was just wondering, how many are really suicidal?
We probably get, in terms of suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, we probably are getting, I would say, 5 to 10 of those calls a day. Over the week, if you average it out, with suicidal ideation. And then there's within that a whole range. There's mild suicidal to actively suicidal. But I would say with suicidal ideation, there's 5 to 10 calls a day for suicidal calls.
I've never heard a number that high. But
with suicidal ideation, a lot of people have suicidal thoughts. And so that's what they do report when they're reporting that they have thoughts, not that they have intent. So those obviously are much less.
Okay. And it is 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so I still need to understand how when someone is suicidal, it calls in. I have heard from veterans, they don't want to call a military helpline. Okay,
mm-hmm.
that's what I have heard.
Mm-hmm.
And they associate the military with something that has really caused, or it has roots of
sure.
why they are suicidal. So I'm wondering how you can do outreach to these men to make it a safe environment. It's very difficult for me, having worked with people who are suicidal, how you can, I guess I'd have to be there and see what you actually do. Maybe that mm-hmm. would be the best thing in understanding how mm-hmm. your call center works.
We would love to have you come for a visit. We'd
yeah,
be happy
that,
to provide you a tour.
Because I just have too many questions,
yeah,
and I so want to have quality care regarding these people who are at risk of taking their lives. So
we'd be
so
happy to
it's just interesting that the $100,000 went to the military helpline. I think that's what I
find very, very interesting, because it really does cost a whole lot more money, but it's because you already had that infrastructure that you felt that that should go there.
Yeah. See,
or that why
I don't understand the question.
General Caldwell chose
Mr. Chair.
That one.
I think, Madam Chairman, or Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, when we first entered into the contract with Cascade, the one of their obvious selling points was that they currently do all state employees, but 55,000 state employees, all of my state employees, we inform them every, you know, all the time, here's your employee helpline, assistance line. So they're already doing that. I think I asked that very question when we first met. I said, I got some concerns here because, you know, there's a significant gap between the bids here, and you were the lowest one. And they informed me at the time, and I walked through their center. They showed me the whole thing. They said, we got capacity. We're not having to build capacity. It's already here. The infrastructure is in place. The systems are in place. So this is a very easy step for us to do. The most significant thing was probably the web pages and the telephone line had to be vetted out. So I left there feeling quite good about this was going to be successful. And what we've seen in the contract execution, like I said, they've either met everything timely or they've exceeded the expectations. So we have no issues at all with the contract being met and worked at this point. The other thing that wasn't brought up is we're also, and have been for almost 2 years inside the Oregon National Guard, we've been doing resiliency training to our leaders and to our soldiers. We've encouraged them to use these methods, whether they be, we don't care what helpline they go to. There's several of them out there. There's a couple of national ones. There's, of course, the former one, Oregon Partnership, still in business and doing their thing. And then this is the one that we have at this point in time. So we don't say you can only call one or you can only call the other. We say here are the resources, use them. And that's really, I think, helped a lot. And also our teaching our leaders to be able to identify it, like the example that Colonel Kuhl gave here, was that these squad leaders are now recognizing things that 3 years ago they would have just let it go by. So we've spent a lot of time and effort trying to do that, which is also part of their effort right now to get to our Yellow Ribbon events and do more of this type of training. Knock on wood, but we have not had a suicide of one of our soldiers in, I think, what, 14, 15, 16 months? And we've had a ton of them that have reported ideations, and a lot of them that we know of that have gone through their chain of command or heard otherwise, and we see it from the data that these people give us and others give us. So I think we're making progress in that regard. And it's never a perfect, there is no perfect situation, but we have made significant progress.
You know, when you, I think, first reported several months ago on suicide, how many suicides there are, what I would like from you at some point is, how many suicides are we having in the state of Oregon? I mean, I'd like to see if we're making a dent. But I'd also like to know exactly the data from Cascade Center regarding the number of calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you probably tracked that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It would be extremely interesting to me because I've got them from other centers, and I just would like to see not cooked, but
okay,
real actual
we
numbers. I get nervous
report
about giving me stuff that I want to see rather than what it really is.
We have a utilization report that's tied to the calls, so when we set up a case, that goes into the report, and that's able to be accessed online by the guard at any time they want. So it can't be cooked. It's tied to our database. It's based on the calls that come in, and we collect that data. And so you're able, and we can certainly show you that data.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And I'm getting rumblings to my right that I've overstated the time of my questions, so I will now defer. Thank you very much for the time that you allowed me to ask these very important questions.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Senator Courtney, please.
Dr. Marsh, I remember the testimony a few months ago. This is the one, and there was some riveting things going on that day. So I'm not going to get into this territorial battle, please. I'm not trying to put you in the defensive. As I understand it, the legislature stepped up and gave them some money to keep it going because the feds didn't. Is that right?
Yeah.
You do know that.
Gave to...
The legislature allocated funds to
sure
make up for the fact the feds bailed. You do know that. So I think what I'm trying to say is the Oregon legislature, for better or worse, and the governor, and National General Caldwell, I think we've shown over and over again, both through legislation and everything else, we approach these things in a very bipartisan manner. We do care about our veterans, and we know they're struggling. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious. Two things. One of the things that was said, I think, by the provider ahead of you, is you call it providers. What do you call them?
Provider.
Can I call them a provider?
Right.
You're right on.
But the previous provider was that so many other states didn't even have it or didn't care. They didn't say they didn't care. That poor Oregon, I don't say poor Oregon because I'm proud of her, basically they were getting calls from, I believe, Idaho, Washington, and Alaska even, if I'm right.
Yeah.
And we didn't say no, right?
We didn't say no.
We took them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that happening with you?
Have we gotten calls from other states?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, we get a few calls. We've got a unit that trained in Texas. We got some calls from Texas, but we're not getting, those were National Suicide Hotline calls that the other contractor had a contract with, so we don't have that same contract they have. So they're still getting those calls for the suicide, the National Suicide Hotline.
I don't understand that at all. What happened there?
Let me ask a more simple question and then go back to Senator Courtney. Is your 800 number work nationwide or does it work just in Oregon?
It works nationwide.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we don't deny. So, you know, if somebody called from another state, we don't deny that service. We would serve the person on the phone.
Senator, maybe when he talked about the National Suicide Hotline there, and I forget it, it's Military One Source, I believe. And I may be wrong, but if the call comes in there and it's a person that lives in Oregon, for instance, or I deployed with the 41st Brigade out of Oregon, okay, fine. They'll kick it to what they have in their databases. Who's in Oregon that does that? And that's what I think you were trying to state there. So the call may have come from Texas, goes to the national folks, and they say, hang on, boom. Then it goes to whatever they had, which in this case would be Cascade, as our line. And they would pick it up. Even though the individual's in Texas, somehow they knew it was an Oregon-based unit. Something created that to get it to Oregon.
Okay, one last question. So you got to put up with me because I'm old. I'm very old. So your card says you're in Portland.
Yes.
Fern Loop. Suite 1A. What?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now is that where all the counselors are sitting there at the phone booths up there? They're up there.
Right. They're in offices, a combination of offices and some cubicles. Mm-hmm.
So when the call comes in, it isn't somebody in India?
No. They're all in Portland.
All right.
Peggy from Pakistan.
Okay. Now,
no Peggy.
Okay. So let me ask you this. This is a $133,000 contract. Is that right?
$103,000.
You're doing other things, aren't you?
Sure. We started as employee assistance services.
No, don't see that. You just did it to me. That's not helping me a bit.
I'm sorry.
Tell me what. So you're counselors to the world?
We contract, we work with various employers, and we provide counseling services to their employees.
Oh, so you, what you mean, you provide this thing that you do to many employers and the National Guard?
Right. They're separate lines, so when it comes in, we know it's the military helpline. But yes, we provide also to other people.
This is going to get me in trouble. You always better not use it against me. I would assume... Well, I'll be careful here.
Let me write this down.
Yeah, go ahead. Be careful. I don't want to say that people who are struggling with your employers or jobs don't have serious problems. I didn't say that out there. But I assume that these veterans, when they make a call many times, we're dealing with something very, very serious. I didn't say the others that make calls weren't having struggling with life. Do you understand that, my fellow Republican? I didn't say that.
Well,
you get what I'm saying to you?
Absolutely correct.
So that when the call comes in from a veteran, because I'm not a fool, because they can be constituents. I'm not saying that...
You're not running for re-election, I am.
Do you have special lights or buttons? I want to be sure that the veteran...
Yeah.
Because we could be talking some real desperate stuff going on. Real, real, real. It isn't just suicide. Some of the poor veterans are getting in trouble with the law,
right.
And it's serious.
Right.
Real serious. So you know instantly when the call comes in, this is a veteran. You do know that?
Yeah, I completely agree with you, first of all. It is very serious. So just to even describe the technology in detail. So on our phones, there's a little readout. And that it says when, like if I'm the one in the call center and my phone rings, it'll say Military Assistance Helpline. So I know that it's coming from a vet calling on that line, a service member calling on that line, and I answer in that way, and I'm ready as a master's level counselor to take that call.
And
so
when
it tells me.
And when you've talked, Dr. Marshall, sorry I interrupt you, with your 14, how many counselors did you say?
We have 15 total counselors.
Have you talked to them specifically about that?
Definitely. Oh, certainly. I mean, that was extensive piece of the training. So there's always the technology training and how that works. They were familiar with that. But we've had a lot of training with in terms of even the type of calls they're going to get, in terms of that military culture, so the ones that aren't vets.
Do these counselors, are they there like 8 to 5?
They have a staggered schedule. So some come in so that we're there to different times. So some are 10 to 7, 9 to 6.
So nobody's there from 1 to 4 o'clock in the morning?
Yes. We have counselors who staff the phones all 24 hours a day.
You have people sitting in that hours all 24/7?
We work with Protocol Services that also is American Association of Suicidology. So they, our calls are transferred. The call goes into their call center. They're in Portland.
Would they get the same, if I happen to get transferred, would I get the same live voice?
You don't get transferred, it just rings right
in. But my point, would I get, you represented to Senator Montes Anderson that when you make a call, there isn't going to be some little message going
There's
on.
There's not.
Push buttons, it's a human voice.
Yep.
No matter when I make it. 24/7, Saturday and Sunday.
Answered Oregon Military Helpline, Christmas, New Year's Day, all
Thank
the
you.
Holidays.
Sorry it took so long.
Senator Olson, you have a question?
Boy, they've... Well, I have a bunch of them, so I'll make and I'll just hush.
Okay. And I guess, Doctor, this you're not probably going to be able to answer a bunch of these questions, but I'd like you to get back to us because I think it's pertinent, and it's pertinent to what Senator Montes Anderson has raised as issues and what Senator Courtney has raised as issues. First off, let me preface it with saying, I mean, what Senator Courtney raised, I mean, front page Wall Street Journal Monday, Tuesday this week, PTSD is, you know, violent strike. I mean, for those that are old as I guess all of us up here, maybe the exception of the counselor here, we're at the end of Vietnam again. We're seeing this all over. Federal government's bailing. We're back at Vietnam. We're going to have problems. They're going to dump it on the states. And, oh, by the way, I have a feeling, you know, unless you know, the two Democrats here, and he wanted to raise campaign issues, have something to say come November, before I'm gone 4 years from now, we're going to be back trying to fund this thing ourselves because the feds are going to bail. That I got. So here's my question here, and what I understand you're doing. You have a series of state government contracts, and I think there must be a series of agencies within the state government that you provide these services to already.
Right. We provide, well, for the, you're talking about just for the state of Oregon?
Your center. Yeah. We're talking physical plant here. We're talking your infrastructure is set up.
Right.
Because you can't do this for $100,000 if you walked in off the street. But you have an existing series of state government contracts.
We have one contract for the state of Oregon Employee Assistance Program. But we also contract with both other private and public entities. So we do have that contract with the state of Oregon, but there's also other private employers and counties and cities and things that we have contracts with.
Okay. Well, give us a little background on the state government. Here's my concern.
Okay.
We're basically subsidizing the veterans line across the broad spectrum. I'm from the private sector. Virtually everybody here is working in the private sector, including Senator Courtney. I mean, I raise an eye here and say, this is a good business development. You do this once, you get it down smart. You can go to other states and other places, and you can get other contracts. So I see how this can work, and I see how the force multiplier goes into this. My concern comes down to this. We face state budget cuts, and
Certainly.
You lose your contract with the state of Oregon. You can't do this for $100,000. You're going to go under. We got that. So
No. We won't. State of Oregon is one contract. If we lose the state of Oregon, we're not going to go under. We have many contracts with different entities. The state of Oregon is one contract. So, no, we're not going to go under if we lose the state of Oregon.
So let me follow up then. Obviously, it's a public contract. How large is the contract? And you said it's all state employees. Is it a
DAS
contract?
It's about 45,000 employees that are covered.
And so it's a DAS contract that I'm assuming? And it's can you give us a little assurances here? My guess is this must be required in the collective bargaining. There's some reason the state of Oregon is doing this. There must be some law we already have why we have to have you guys do this to start with.
I don't know if that there's a law. I could get back to you on that and work with PEB, but I know that it is a benefit. They found a value, and we work with their insurer and coordinate with that. So there's a lot of services that we help them with. I don't know if I'm answering
your
question.
Did you say
PEB? PEB. I did say PEB.
Okay.
You said PEB.
Right, PEB.
Sorry.
That's a popular term.
I know.
Right now,
I know.
With the members. Now we're all getting our tape out and checking our waist here, right?
You're not PEB, but certainly.
Okay. But what I'd like to do is I'd like to get, you know, if you could get back to us, because I know you don't have the answers, but, you know, some warm and fuzzy. I mean, we bailed this out. Was it 500,000, 800,000? What do we?
Mr. Chairman, I think it was around three. It went to, 350, something like that, went to ODVA. It didn't go to us.
Right, I know. Right. I know. I think it's closer to five.
Could be.
We bailed it out for five because the feds jumped ship and they're going to jump again. And I think the committee's concern here is, and I'll be blunt, it's a good dog and pony show. It sounds like you're doing good things.
Mm-hmm.
These guys know what I'm talking about here, but I'm used to having those sort of dog and pony shows, right, General?
Yes.
So I know how they go. The concern comes down to the brass tacks, and that's money. And, you know, this isn't a $100,000 program. You've already described a program that's at 250 or 300 the way we're doing it. And I understand that, and I understand your business model. Our concern just comes down to being the simple fact that, you know, if something goes awry in the state budget or something along that line, and I don't know what it is because we don't understand what your other public contracts are,
right,
that we could be in hot water real quick.
Mr. Yeah. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Well, I can interject. What does it cost? Have you figured out per cost per patient what it costs to deal with someone on a crisis intervention? You obviously have because you come up with a number and you said you could do it for this amount of money.
Right, right. So I don't know that I could give you that off the top of my head.
Would the committee's assumption be that you figure that you're maybe only going to talk to 20 or 25 or 100 patients?
In terms of the figuring out that cost?
Yes.
Well, we do look at utilization. I don't know that I could get to you numbers in terms of what we feel the cost is. It varies because some calls are very intensive and some are not. So there is a wide variance that way in terms of the cost. But I could get you, if you want some numbers in terms of cost per call, I could get you that data.
Because I do, Mr. Chair, I do have sympathy with them because I'm in an industry where sometimes specifics aren't enough and you're not quite certain and you have to really make a guesstimate as to where you will be.
Sure.
And if this is an organization that's committed and they have other clients that create other jobs, because typically most businesses don't sell to just one person, I don't know that we should have extreme paranoia over whether they would be able to take care. Is the paranoia over whether they will be able to take care of the clients?
I think the bottom line is you can't provide the service for $100,000. It's being prorated across the broader spectrum. I need to interrupt, Buster.
Sure.
Obviously, General Caldwell, you haven't hired a new director of emergency management yet, right?
That is correct.
You're being summoned by the governor's office, so I think we can continue with the two doctors here, and you can go back to
work. Well, I turned my phone off as directed, Mr. Chairman.
we have not, and I've been asked to ask you to leave. So,
my pleasure.
So,
I have able-bodied people.
Right,
you can call on.
Mr. Chair, I have one quick question.
I have a couple follow-ups, too, so go ahead.
It's really important for me to know how many Oregon military men are being and women are being served by the suicide prevention line.
Mm-hmm.
That piece of it.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Mon Anderson, when we developed our bid for the contract, we estimated that there would be approximately 20,000 individuals that would be associated with this project. That includes family members, children, adult dependents. So about 20,000 individuals that would fall under this contract.
In 1 year?
Total. That's the population.
The population.
The Oregon National Guard, and then add in some veterans.
Can you expand that? You have 20,000, so obviously, doctor, there's a call rate and a percentage of what you're anticipating going to call. There's a workload. There's a staffing load. You know, there's a mandate calculation. Can you just expand what you just said?
In terms of utilization of calls.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Typically, and it's hard to know, again, and there's ebb and flow of that, but typically we'll get probably about a call of about 10% calls. Now, with this helpline, that's why we're working so hard in answer Senator Mona Anderson, is to publicize. So we've just started. We've just gotten going the last couple months. So we've been averaging, and these are, well, I guess I can't say. They are primarily Oregon calls. We're getting about 5 to 7 a week. So that's not at the level that we want that, the military Oregon calls. I know some have come from out of state, but primarily they are Oregon calls. And they're all Oregon Guard, because that's where we're doing our promotion.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be helpful, as I think both Senator Mona Sanders and I expressed an interest to come visit your call center.
Mm.
That's the first thing it'd be helpful to understand. And the second thing is you know, and you can get back with counsel here, and if we need to go deal with PEB ourselves, we can. But I think it'd be interesting to know, or we need to know kind of the size of the contract, the scope with the state of Oregon, because I got the business model. I understand how you're doing it now. The real question comes down is, you know, as the state gets hammered between the eyes, as the federal government has to cut itself by 40% to survive, you know, we as a bipartisan group have made a decision, you know, many years ago across the board that, you know, we're going to take care of veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a pretty bold move, you know, on the part of the legislature. We turned around in the end and said, look, if the feds are going to abandon ship, it's their total legal responsibility to do this, and they did abandon ship. We stepped up to the plate in a very austere time,
mm-hmm.
and made up the difference. And I fully expect that, you know, at some point in the near future, we could be asked to do the same thing again. But again, it hadn't said that. When you're in austere times, PEB's going to be facing austere times.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, all of your private sector employers out there are facing austere times. It's not going to get any better with the European crisis and everything else going on. And so, you know, I recognize and I appreciate the fact that you're really subsidizing this program from elsewhere because you had excess capacity. You've just filled it. But I think the committee remains concerned about what happens next when the feds abandon ship and the $100,000 that contract goes away because we can't use the federal contract.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes away or is it canceled, as you well know, come October 1 could be canceled,
mm-hmm.
And we have to pick it up. Our price tag is probably not going to be $100,000 to pick it up if the state's already cutting back elsewhere. So, and the PEB should be public information, I'm assuming, if you can check on that, counselor. And that contractual information so that we get a better grasp. And then I think we'll look forward to trying to set it up a time when several of us can come visit the call center. I greatly appreciate what you're doing. I understand you're doing and the good work. It's just what's next, because
mm-hmm.
next is coming.
Sure.
We've seen it from the Vietnam War. We're seeing it in veterans. The present Secretary of Defense and the present Joint Chiefs of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have said they want to cut veterans benefits and they want to cut personnel costs. And again, Monday, Wall Street Journal, PTSD violence mm-hmm. is skyrocketing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they're coming. I'll close with one comment, and that's I think that the old line is getting a lot of the calls that at some point are going to come to you.
And that's fine. I mean, we would be prepared if they wanted to somehow forward that line to us or transfer that to us. So we are very prepared for that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Vice Chair, questions? Senator Courtney, questions?
I just hope you know, Dr. Marshall, and I hope we haven't offended you. You have in Senator Olson and Senator Mona Sanders and Senator Boquist, not in me. These people really know budgets. They really know business models and things. You've been asked a lot of questions about contracts and bids. But if you could have seen this committee over the period of the last general session, this is two Democrats and two Republicans. This committee is totally even. I think you would see that when that's all put aside, and there's a very nice presentation. Probably as we spoke here today, calls came in from a man or woman who was on the brink of doing something terrible to their mate or their child, or going out and playing in the traffic, or they're smashed or doing something. And I just hope that is the bottom line here, because the last time we had this meeting, and he had to grab me and calm me down because I got into the federal bureaucracy and I just didn't want to hear it anymore.
Yeah.
I don't care anymore. There are people suffering over there that we say are our heroes. We sent them over there. I've been to a number of the deployments and the demobilization. I've been to some of the funerals. Now, I'm not bragging. I just have been more. And I'm just going to tell you, we have demonstrated over and over again that the condition of these men and women when they come back from putting themselves in harm's way is of a concern. So we're into numbers and the contracts thing. I just hope when you leave here you understand. I'm not asking you not to take care of your other clients, but I hope that this group of individuals is truly the magnitude of how we see them is very important as elected officials. It isn't just we're trying to protect our taxpayers' dollars, and I think Chair's right. Oh, yeah, I know what's coming. They're going to come to the Oregon legislature now and forever, and we're going to have to be a part of this. I'm just going to say it, Brian. I think
we're going to do it.
And you know what? We're not turning our back. We're going to do it even if the sky's falling, because
mm-hmm.
that's just what we do. So I just hope you understand that there's charts, no disrespect, there's this, all that. That call, if it's coming in now, I just hope somebody's answering. I hope everybody understands. They're going to the wall to try to save them. You have your doctors, your counselors, you've got the skills to save these people, to help them. I just hope that that comes out of this meeting more than anything else. Just my opinion. I can't speak for my other three callers.
Chair and members of the committee, Senator Courtney, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, if anything comes across in our presentation, we take this very seriously and are very passionate about the ability to do this service. So I want you to hear that that is very true of us as an organization. And I don't take it personally because I know where you are coming from and your concern and why you invited us today.
Chair Olson?
I have a couple points. Number one, when you bring your data back to us to chat, if you could tell us the average length of time you deal with a patient or a client. What would you call him, a patient, a client?
Client.
Client. Mm-hmm. If you would tell us the average amount of time that you would spend with him, because I've just done the math on your budget. Assuming that you would do seven a day. And I think, once again, you know, I think our biggest concern and where my colleagues and I are coming from is you get what you pay for. And it's not so much that we're concerned about, you know, you bid it low. I mean, you're low bid. But we're concerned about, at low bid, can you provide what our soldiers need?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what we're after.
Certainly. Yes.
And if you can, the more power to you, because we love you because we can work you into our budget. But if you can't, we're going to leave somebody out there that needs to be helped.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think that was our...
We do, too.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Gould. Or Colonel Gould, Dr. Gould. Appreciate you coming forward. Committee members, I'd remind you... Thank you, Matt.
Okay.
I just remind you that I think we're meeting Tuesdays from 8 to 10 during the February session. There's only three meetings.
What day?
It's Tuesdays, I believe, from 8
Tuesday?
To 10. 8 to 10 in the morning. We only have four meetings maximum. I think we have two meetings in which we have to have stuff to the far chamber or going to our floor to the far chamber, and then we have two more meetings at the end. So I think we only have a total of three.
We have 911.
That's right.
Yeah, right. I heard 911.
Yeah, right. For us senior senators, we're familiar with, and we'll be meeting in this room. So mark your schedules for that because we'll be moving out very quickly because what we have to cover fast because, unlike other committees, we only have 2 hours per week and a few meetings. I appreciate everybody's concern with the call center, and when we try and set up some time, we'll try and coordinate to see as many members could go down and visit the call center. Anything else, Madam Vice Chair?
Okay.
Senator Courtney?
No, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson?
No, sir.
This meeting is adjourned.
Yeah.